And welcome to another episode of Gopher Gridiron Radio. I'm Luke Buer.
And I'm GopherIllustrated.com publisher Ryan Burns. And we welcome you guys back to this breakdown edition of Minnesota's 44-31 Big Ten victory over Purdue on a lovely Saturday afternoon. Unfortunately, if you were a deer hunter like I was, record highs this weekend were not so optimal for deer movement. But this is not a deer hunting podcast. And this is my one disclaimer that unfortunately for Luke and I and for all you listeners, Derek is on assignment this week. He is traveling throughout the country and he does not have the amount of time needed to record this podcast. So he will be back next week, but he is on assignment this week. So Luke, I guess it's just good enough for you and I. How's that sound to you?
That's fine. I'll do my best. I'm no Derek Burns by any stretch of the imagination, but I will, as they say, fake it till you make it.
I think that's, if that's what we're talking about within the first 2 minutes of this episode, I think it's going to be a dandy.
It's going to be really good. Okay. Let's talk about this game, Ryan. First and foremost, I don't know if you noticed, but it's the first week in November and the Gophers are 7-2. Now I realize we have talked schedule and how weak it has been, you know, relative to last year for sure. And probably relative to the last handful of years, but I mean, complain all you want. The Gophers are 7-2. Yeah, could they be 9-0? Sure, but they're 7-2. Like we have something to hang our hats on in November, and you got a chance to kind of control your destiny going into the remaining three games, and that's something that just doesn't happen too often.
And here's the crazy part about this: Minnesota on this 4-game Big Ten winning streak has scored 30 points or more in each game, like. This offense, which we're going to talk about, because Minnesota put up 44 points. I think they could have been well north of 58 if they would have just done some little things here and there better. But a 4-game winning streak in the Big Ten heading into now a very, very interesting game in Lincoln this weekend with the Tommy Armstrong news. I'm very curious to see if he practices this week or if he ends up playing, because this is something that I think Luke and I, and I know a couple other people were talking about, is that there are a few key players on each and every team in the Big Ten. And if they go down, that's the complete complexion of their team changes. You look at Minnesota, I would say Rodney Smith, Demaryius Travis,
Mitch Leidner,
Steven Richardson would be amongst the ones that come immediately to mind. And Tommy Armstrong, obviously for good reason, is probably the most vital part of that Nebraska team. And you saw them absolutely get just slapped in the face, just mentally and physically, with a 62-3 loss to Ohio State last weekend. So Minnesota's got the momentum. Nebraska doesn't. And the other thing I'm sure we're going to get into here next, Luke, is I think the really frustrating part about this 4-game winning streak in the Big Ten for Minnesota fans is the fact that they have yet to play a complete game. And that is so incredibly frustrating, folks. I'm not immune to everything I get on the Twitter sphere or on Gopher Illustrated. I see it all, and I'm with you. And that's something I think we've been talking about frequently on this podcast, was the fact that we really wanted to see this Golden Gopher football team play a complete game in all three facets, whether it's offense, defense, and special teams. And we've yet to see that still. And again, you think Minnesota coming off back-to-back 40-point performances, we'd be talking and singing the praises of this Gopher offense. But there still are just these nagging things that can turn this team into a legitimate Big Ten West contender. I know the standings say that Minnesota is one, but I'm still not convinced, but we'll find out more this weekend and in the following week against Northwestern. But even still, Luke, it's great to be 7-2. Yes, we could talk about what the season potentially could have been if a couple of things go their way earlier in the season. But 7-2 is 7-2, and 4 straight Big Ten wins is something that I'm not really going to complain about more times than not, because it has happened so rarely in Golden Gopher football history, and Minnesota's been able to take advantage of a very soft schedule. You know, I far see more criticism from Gopher fans about their schedule than a Vikings team that has looked like absolute trash the last 3 weeks. And it's crazy that folks aren't pointing at their soft schedule, because the Vikings haven't beat anyone.
Right.
I think their best win right now is the Packers. And the Packers just lost to the Colts.
Yeah.
Like, they haven't beat anybody, but neither really has Minnesota to an extent, and they'll have their chance to do so this weekend.
All right. So let's I think what we should do is, you know, we've talked a lot about, and you referenced already that the Gophers haven't played a complete game. And I think this Purdue game somewhat epitomizes that, you know, in a large, or in kind of a nutshell. So let's kind of go through the different phases and talk about, you know, what went well, what went poorly. And let's start with probably you've already referenced that the offense, they put 44 points on the board, and you're thinking, if you didn't watch the game, you would have thought they played fantastic. But, you know, that wasn't necessarily the case. They had moments, but it was not a complete game by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah. First guy I have to talk about is Rodney Smith, and it's not even close. Rodney Smith gained 153 rushing yards on 24 attempts on Saturday. Comes out to about 6.4 yards per carry with 3 rushing touchdowns. It is absolutely remarkable, considering the way that this offensive line blocked, that Rodney was able to do everything that he was able to do. And he is in the top 3 in so many statistical categories in Big Ten play. And I honestly think we do need to start mentioning him in the same breath as, Saquon Barkley is, I think, far and beyond the best running back in the Big Ten.
Yes.
But Rodney is absolutely in that conversation, that second tier, with guys like Mike Weber, Justin Jackson, and Corey Clement. I think Rodney has done so much more with less than any other back. I think this season, Northwestern is playing a good brand of football right now. Justin Jackson has been able to do some things. Mike Weber has all these 4- and 5-star kids blocking on his offensive line. And Corey Clement obviously has that famous Wisconsin offensive line in front of him. This offensive line, in my opinion, blocked their worst game of the season on Saturday, and Minnesota was still able to put up 44 points. It was just so inconsistent. Rodney had one of his 3 touchdowns that was behind a great combo block from Vincent Calhoun and Jonah Perzig, so he could grind right behind them into the end zone. But Rodney is just able to make so many people miss. He flashes everything you want in a running back, power on that touchdown run. And on his first touchdown, he's able to show off that speed and elusiveness to get the 35 yards. And then finally, on his final touchdown run, he just beats the guy to the pylon. Then he cuts inside and is able to get the touchdown run. He had another long run there that he just showed. He was able to weave in and out of traffic. It's not even like it was jump cuts. It was just fast weaving. And with no Shannon Brooks, which was a very surprise, inactive. And that's the one thing about college football compared to the NFL is you have no injury report.
Right.
And so the only thing we see about injuries is Tuesday when Minnesota comes out with a fake injury. I won't say fake, but what good is a Tuesday injury report when you're 5 days away from a game? We the media really didn't know anything was going on until about 2 hours before kickoff. And then we see Shannon not dressed on the sidelines and things are like, why isn't Shannon playing? And then it comes out, he has an ankle injury because he was practicing all week. I was asking people like, what is going on? They're like, well, he was practicing through Thursday. And it sounds like the decision was made after practice on Thursday to rest him and get him ready for Nebraska. And again, I can't say I blame him, but Rodney Smith is fantastic, folks. I've seen some people try and compare him to David Cobb. I don't really see that. I think that Cobb and Rodney Smith are much more are far different runners in terms of their style of play and just even their body types. But Rodney is fantastic, folks. I think he's going to likely end the season at, 18 rushing touchdowns and 1,200 yards. He's already at 954 yards right now with 13 rushing touchdowns. So you think in their final 3 games and in the bowl game, it's not out of the realm of possibilities for Rodney Smith to have 18 rushing touchdowns. And here's the other crazy thing, Luke. This rushing game has now produced back-to-back 5 rushing touchdown weeks. This offensive line isn't necessarily playing well. How crazy is that?
It is crazy. Well, you know, to compliment Rodney, I thought Leidner ran the ball exceptionally well, especially on the read option, right? And I,
Oh my gosh, he was fantastic in the read option.
He was great. I think for the most part this season they've done less read and more of like a design quarterback keep, right? But this week they definitely honed in on that read, and Mitch was great on the give and the pull, and when to give and when to pull. You know, he had 14 carries for 74 yards, 5.3 yards a clip, and that's pretty impressive. And in like the commentary on TV, you know, I haven't thought about it. He is deadly in the red zone running the ball. I've really not noticed that or thought much about that. But of late, you know, when you have that second option being him, where you have to honor his run, it helps the whole running game out.
Mitch was fantastic in the read option, and when it was good to see, because you watch back that game. And by the way, that game took forever to watch back, 4 hours brutal. In real time. And then you have to go. It was brutal. But the amount of times that, and Mitch even talked about in the press conference afterwards, and I 100% agree with his assessment, the defensive ends for Purdue were crashing down on these running backs far more than what they had shown on film. And so because of that, Leidner is, okay, he's reading the defensive end. If he thinks he's crashing, he pulls the ball and he runs outside. And he was having a lot of success doing so. And we were clamoring for some more Mitch on the ground, because, you know, there was some speculation even from this podcast, like, is Mitch hurt? Because he's not running as much. But, from what he told the media afterwards, he was just the looks he was getting weren't conducive to him getting chunks of yardage on the ground. And you saw that the looks that he was given on Saturday with these defensive ends crashing down were allowing him to spring it to the next level. And so with no Shannon Brooks, I think that this staff did a very good job of maybe even getting some Mitch Leidner design runs in there, trying to take the load off Rodney Smith. Again, Rodney had 24 carries. Kobe McCrary only had 5. I'm a little surprised by that. But again, the way Rodney has been playing at this such a high level, there's not really a tremendous need to really bring in Kobe there, because Shannon is much more closer to the level Rodney Smith is than Kobe McCrary is right now. And there's no slight at Kobe. I just think that Shannon and Rodney are far and beyond what Kobe is right now. But as back to Mitch, him in the running game was very successful. Again, as you mentioned, 5.3 yards a carry, 2 rushing touchdowns. He's now got 30 rushing touchdowns in his career, which is amongst the top 5 in Golden Gopher football history. There is no denying that Mitch is an absolute weapon in the red zone, and you saw that again on Saturday.
Well, let's talk about that passing game. Mitch was what?
Can we start again? I know people. Can we just start with that play before the end of the half? I mean, we'll come back to the positives, which were Mitch throwing in these deep balls that Minnesota is now no longer the worst team in FBS football in their longest pass completion. But
sure,
let's just start with the play before the end of the half.
All right. So play of the end of the half. What is it? 15 seconds. You have it on what? Your 20-ish yard line. No timeouts, right? Yeah, I think that's about correct. And I guess if I'm going to be honest with you, Ryan, I was watching on TV. I got to the game late, so I very much take advantage of my fast forward button when watching college football, and being a Gopher fan, that works quite well because they take quite a bit of time in between plays. So I took it for granted that they were going to take a knee. I actually texted you this, and I fast forwarded all the way through halftime and saw the score and was shocked to see the score. So shocked that I had to rewind all the way back to see that Mitch had thrown an interception on what looked to be 4 verticals. And I was flabbergasted. I put this, I know it's a bad throw by Mitch, but I put this 100% on the shoulders of the coaching staff. I don't know why, when you're up, what, 23-21, you're in with 15 seconds left and probably no chance of getting into field goal range. I get that Carpenter was fantastic kicking field goals yesterday. That's another thing we should touch on later. But I have no idea why you do that. None.
Yeah, so let's set the scene here. And it goes back to the previous drive where Minnesota completes a deep ball to Eric Carter. They're in the red zone. They're at 4th-and-1 at the Purdue 11. And the previous play is reviewed. It was a Leidner completion of Drew Olatarski on the sidelines. They were trying to see if Drew was in or not. And then Purdue calls a timeout. And then Minnesota comes back out on the field with their offense and tries to go hard count Doesn't work. They call a timeout, and then they just settle for a field goal. Okay, we're going to come back to that. The next drive is the one where they have 15 seconds left with on their own 23, no timeouts, and they go four verts, which is fine, and Leidner throws it 15 yards down the field. The defensive back, who is playing way back, they had seven dropping into coverage. Waltarski hadn't even got to him yet, and Leidner throws it. And the defensive back just undercuts it, brings it back to the two. So let's start with the coaching angle here is, why are you risk averse on fourth and one in the red zone against the worst team against the run in the Big Ten, but yet you decide to put the foot on the gas pedal with 15 seconds left on your own 23 with no timeouts? I think that's the first criticism that fans have come to mind, and I think it's worth a fair conversation is, why are you not willing to go for it in the red zone in a much more optimal situation? Again, I can point to the offensive line play as many others could, but you have a very talented running back, and I think that you can get a creative play call there potentially, or whatever you want to do with Jay Johnson there. But that is a situation where I think you already – so you're 21-20 on that in that possession. Why not go for it there? Worst-case scenario, Purdue has to go the length of the field. They have to go at least 85-plus yards to get a touchdown, but you decide to kick a field goal. I mean, so far, what do you think of that, Luke?
Well, I guess I can kind of understand the rationale of why they kicked the field goal, right? I think the field goal puts them up, and that's something that Kill and Clays have been big on. I don't mean to lump those together. I think that there's a lot of importance having momentum going into halftime is kind of what Clays has he has instilled, or at least finds value in that, right? So they kick the field goal. It's kind of the assured way that they can go up. Additionally, to your point, the offensive line, from a consistency standpoint, it was non-existent, and that especially probably throughout that game, but especially in that first half. So the confidence there, you know, maybe just take your chances that you can get the free one on the hard count, and it obviously didn't work. But I guess I don't mind the field goal. I'd rather take the lead. I just don't. I'm with you. I don't get the attempt to just, you know, throw four verts and hope that you get somebody open or get a PI. I just, you know, a PI doesn't help you because it's not a spot foul in college football, right? So it's only 15. I mean, the chances of them getting into field goal range without a timeout and being able to get the clock stopped so you can get your kicker out there, it just makes no sense.
Yeah, and so Tracy talked about that he wanted the lead before half. I get it, because instead of taking, you know, you're taking the sure 3 points, sure in air quotes, from Emma Carpenter. So you go up 23-21, but if you go for it and you don't get it, obviously Purdue gets the ball back with, let's see, about 90 seconds left, and have to go 85 yards, which they had done previously in this half. So I guess I'm just in the favor of that is such and when you look back, obviously hindsight's 20/20. But when you look back at it, it is such a more optimal position for you to go for it there and try to be aggressive than going for it and trying to throw four verts. And there's obviously a miscommunication. And let's get into that a little bit, because Clay's talked about how he relayed the message to Jay Johnson that they had success in the deep passing game. And so he wanted to take one shot down the field. And if they weren't able to convert, they were just going to run it out or kneel it.
But that's another thing that I don't understand. They had success in the deep passing game because of play action, right? Well, with 15 seconds left, no one should bite on play action in that situation. So I guess I don't see them getting behind, right? You got to be in some sort of prevent. I don't get the logic.
Well, let me explain this a little bit first. So Clays relays that to Jay Johnson, saying, I want to take one shot down the field, worst case scenario, it's an arm punt, and Purdue picks it off at their own 40 with like 8 seconds left or so. But that message just was not relayed from Jay Johnson to Adam Weber, from Adam Weber to Mitch Leidner, from Mitch Leidner to Waltarski, because obviously, and I'll have this in the gift breakdown tomorrow, there's an obvious disconnect between what Clays wanted and what the actual execution out on the field was. In my opinion, and, you know, it air quote pains me to say this as a Leidner Island founder, it's on Mitch. You have to know the time and the place and the situation. why in the world would Drew Walutarski be sitting 15 yards, you know, down the field? Even if you complete that, you're at the 40-yard line with about 8 seconds left, where then you have to spike it, and you have 6 seconds left. And what are you going to do, throw a 60-yard bomb? Really?
Yeah, I put this on the coaches. I don't even really care that Mitch – it's irrelevant to me that Mitch throws that, because he shouldn't even be in that situation. I guess that's my point.
Well, here's the thing. Why are you – in what situation do you think Drew's going to be sitting there? Again, they're running four verts, and he had plenty of time in the pocket, so it's not like he had to force the ball out unlike some other times.
Right, I'm not arguing with you. I'm just saying that Mitch shouldn't even be in the position to have to make that decision. That's my point.
Again, I don't disagree with that because I'm with you because you're at your own 23 with no timeouts left with 15 seconds left on the clock. So many more bad things can happen than good things in that kind of a situation. Yeah.
Well,
I'm just trying to explain to you that this is why the execution didn't work, is because there's an obvious disconnect between Jay Johnson, Mitch Leidner, and Drew Walutarski. And again, if you're Mitch, why would you be throwing a 15-yard pass there knowing you have to get at least 40 yards to get into field goal range? You only have 15 seconds left on the clock.
Right.
Again, I see your point. And it's initially when I was sitting in the press box, I'm with you, and I'm still with you to the fact of there are so many more bad things that can happen in that situation where that is the point where you want to be risk-averse and you want to run it out. You have the lead at halftime. Okay, that's exactly what you wanted. Why force it down the field? So, again, I think Minnesota should have still went for it on that 4th-and-1. You're facing the worst run defense in the Big Ten, and you have to get 1 yard. I know it hasn't worked out well for Minnesota in the previous games, but, again, if that's the situation where you want to be aggressive, that's where you do it, not on your own 23 with 15 seconds left and no timeouts.
Okay, let's stick with the coaching bit, right? Savel, first half. Two incredibly long touchdowns by Purdue, largely in part to, I would argue that he put his defensive backs in a really tough situation going cover zero, and
right.
you miss the tackle. I mean, I guess it's, you know, you get once, shame on you, burn me twice, shame on me, right? Like, he got burned twice by making essentially an identical call. And to Purdue's credit, you know, they broke tackles or, you know, made the right play. And that's where you were going to lose. If you were going to lose that game, it was stuff like that. And I know they adjust and they make a huge, huge adjustment in the second half. But I was frustrated in that first half watching some of the defensive scheme calls that they were going with.
Well, Minnesota's going cover zero because they're struggling to get pressure on David
right.
Blau, and he was absolutely picking them apart because of it, because their skill position players were adequate enough to where they could get open after 3, 4, 5 seconds. So on the two long touchdowns, Minnesota goes man across the board, and they try to generate pressure by bringing 5 or 6 guys. And on the long 80-plus yard one, Demaryius Travis gets turned around on a post. He misses the tackle, and he's off to the races. And then Jalen Myrick, I don't know if he was expecting safety help, because the way he was playing that, he was off the line of scrimmage, and he kind of was playing like he was playing like he had help in the center of the field there. It was literally the best route combination to take advantage of the way Myrick was playing. Myrick misses the tackle, and D'Angelo Yancey is fast enough that he's going to outrun Carter Coughlin.
Yeah.
So,
okay, but here's my point. This has been a bend but don't break defense from the minute that Clays and Savel stepped on campus, right?
That's what Tracy Clays' MO was. I don't think that's Jay Savel's.
Okay, that's fair. So maybe this is just an adjustment for me. I'm just used to, you know, we're just not going to beat ourselves. We're going to keep stuff in front of us. Let's make the tackles, and we're going to hopefully put them in just enough uncomfortable a situation where – you know, they're going to make a mistake and we're going to turn them over on downs. Now, to Saville's credit, you know, when they put pressure on it, they've been able to force more turnovers this year. But I thought that first half was about the worst half he's had all season.
Just because he was trying to generate pressure and
right,
he was going cover zero why else do
look
you
at,
think?
Look at their yardage in the first half in that game. So if you take out those big plays, they were able to keep stuff in front and kind of keep things under wraps, but by taking that real aggressive stance, they gave up 14 points and like a bulk of the yardage. I guess that was my frustration. I just didn't want to give Purdue the kind of momentum that they were able to generate, you know, mostly because I was kind of concerned the offense wasn't going to be able to produce the way we were running the ball. But I don't know. It was just frustrating to me. I thought that was a very poorly called game.
All right. Well, let's look at the first half. In terms of their drives, they go 3-and-out, and then they drive down the field because David Blau absolutely puts a beautiful ball in the bucket to D'Angelo Yancey on the sidelines, and then he makes a great throw on a post to their tight end on Jonathan
Celestine.
That was
a great throw, which, for the record, David Blau's good, and could you imagine if he could run just a little bit? Like, he would be just lethal. He is – I like David Blau. I text you that.
I mean, there's a reason he's passing for 40-plus times a game. And
yeah.
He's some of that's good. Because they can't legitimately run the ball, but even still. After that touchdown drive, they go 3-and-out again. And then the 89-yard play comes on 3rd and 11. So Minnesota's in a pass rush situation. They try to go man across the board.
But that's my point. Like my
you
point,
want them to be sitting back in zone there?
No, yeah, but my point is you've got 3rd and 11, right? Like, keep it in front of you more. I mean, what are the odds they get 11? I think you're.
Well, what are the odds that Demaryius Travis gets turned around for the first time in a big spot all season?
Better in cover zero, right? Like, he's just got to miss a tackle. I know he's your sure-handed tackler. I don't know. I just was not expecting it. No, right. I just wasn't expecting it.
Yeah, and then again, and then the next two drives, they go 3-and-out, 3-and-out, and then 3rd and 6. Again, Minnesota has been very underwhelming on 3rd and long all season, and this just doesn't help because Jalen gets burned on a slant that goes 60, but then Savell adjusts and he goes basically cover one the rest of the game with a safety over the top, so it doesn't happen again. Again, fool me once, shame on me, fool me twice, or whatever that saying goes. I mean, it wasn't going to be third time's a charm. But
yeah, so
again,
I mean,
if you think that Savell called a bad game,
no,
I want to disagree with you.
I shouldn't say it was a bad game. He called it what I thought was maybe a bad half that was really highlighted by essentially two calls, right? And I get that it was a breakdown, but it's just frustrating. And to Purdue's credit, they have some skill. Like, they had some skill players that were pretty good. As a Gopher fan, man, there were a couple of receivers I'd be all over to take on our squad.
I'd take D'Angelo Yancey in a heartbeat.
For sure.
Yeah, so let's talk about the Minnesota passing game.
Yeah.
And we alluded to it earlier, folks. Minnesota's no longer the worst team in college football in terms of deep shots, in terms of converting on their deep shots. You saw them convert numerous chunk plays. Minnesota had let's see, how many plays over?
Well, how about this? You rushed the ball 43 times, right? Like, and that's the identity of this team. So you throw it 23 times, and quite frankly, the formula should be to be able to take the pressure off. You got to be able to go deep, and they were able to go deep a handful of times. Mitch was 14 for 23 for 231 yards. He had the one interception. I don't know. I thought they were able to capitalize when they needed to, and they were able to hopefully soften the defense and at least keep them honest. And
yeah, I mean, you saw the first shot of the game. They go play action to Rashad Still, a ball 3 yards deeper, and I think that Still's got a legit shot at a touchdown. And then they go play action again, and Eric Carter is wide open, and it's paining me. I was arguing about this with a good friend of mine named Adam Rosso, who covers the game for 1500. And he's adamant that Leinart should have put that ball, you know, he led him too far. Eric Carter should have caught that ball in stride. Eric Carter dove, in my opinion, because he didn't want to miss the ball. That ball was perfectly placed in terms of he was running under it. If he extends his arms, and I'm doing this and I extend the mic away from my face, but
don't do
he
that.
Extends his arms and it's a touchdown. And he dives because he doesn't want to miss it. But, I mean, if he just puts his arms out, it's a touchdown. And you also see that long completion on the sideline to Rashad Still, who's able to drag his foot there. So Minnesota had play action because they had the Purdue front seven biting on some things, especially defensive backs in the back four. But Leinart was able to put the ball on the money.
And you're averaging 16.5 yards per completion. I mean, that's pretty that's an improvement on what they had been showing, right? You know, 10 yards per attempt, that's pretty solid compared to what we'd been seeing earlier, well, in previous games. And now it's, yeah, we can put the asterisk.
It's Purdue.
Yeah, that's the same asterisk.
For everybody who's thinking that right now, it's Purdue, let's see you do it against Nebraska. But for a passing game that had been struggling, especially for the receivers and trying getting separation deep, they did get separation deep, and Minnesota was able to connect. As you said, 16.5 yards per completion. You saw Drew Olatarski get a nice catch and run on a crossing route. Still makes a couple of plays there. Eric Carter, for all of you non-Brian Anderson truthers out there, gets some time and gets a 51-yard bomb there. I still have my qualms with this receiving core.
Yeah,
there were a couple of times where they didn't get enough separation. Liner tries to make the throw out to them on, say, like an 8 to 10 yard pass, and the defensive back comes over their back because they can't create enough separation. But again, it is a step in the right direction.
And Liner definitely was not flawless, right? He had a couple he threw in the dirt. You know,
he had a couple of ground balls, and he obviously has that pick at the end of the half.
Yeah,
I'm just so tired of dealing with. Or just listening to people who think that Mitch should be a Division III linebacker. Again, I understand you may not like Mitch Liner. You may not like that he's been the Gopher starting quarterback for the last few years. But if you can't see that he does some good things, and I think personally he did more good things than bad against Purdue, then I don't know that you can you know what I'm trying to say, Luke? Like, well, if you can't see what I see, and I can 100% see the things that Liner doesn't do that you know, he doesn't do well. And again, I've already talked about that at length here on this podcast, but in that same breath, if you can't be able to recognize that he does do some good things and you just hang your hat on the fact that he should be a Division III linebacker somewhere, then I don't know that you should be listening anymore, because if you just want to hear what you want to hear, you're not going to get this. You know what I mean?
Okay. When it comes to Mitch, you know, you have some good and you have some bad. I get that. But there's a lot more to just, you know, making the throws. This year in particular, you know, they're putting him in positions to make a lot of reads, which he's usually getting us into good play sets. Additionally, I mean, where would you be without him in this game, without the 14 carries for 74 yards? And he hit on a 60% clip. I mean, you know, passing the ball, I'm with you. I don't know.
With an average completion of 16.5 yards. So it's not like he was dinking and dunking.
No, it wasn't. Right. I thought he played well. But were there plays? Did the offense leave plays out in the field?
Yes.
Absolutely. Did they leave points? Absolutely. This is to the point they haven't played a complete game yet. And, you know, quite frankly, I don't know, you know, with the remaining competition, I don't know if you're going to get a lot better in the next few games. But, I mean, this is, from a points perspective, this is as good as they've been in the last, 3 years. Like, you can't complain too much. And I know the competition isn't great, but it isn't what it is every year. But, I mean, man, what do you want? They're not Alabama.
Yeah, I'll put quarterback to an end, and we'll get into this offensive line. But for all you Connor Rota truthers out there, or truthers, maybe Connor can do some things that Mitch can do in the passing game, but there is no way, shape, or form Connor can hold a breath to what Mitch is able to do in the read option game. And that is a vital part of Minnesota's offense under Jay Johnson, is the aspect of a running quarterback. And that's where Leidner is far and beyond so much more ideal for a Jay Johnson offense. Maybe Connor can do some more things in the passing game. I didn't see that off video when I watched him against Maryland. But again, if you have qualms about quarterback recruiting, that's fine. The guys who made those decisions are no longer here. And we'll have to see what Jay Johnson does with Mark Williams, if he does remain at quarterback, and Seth Green, and what they end up doing here in this 2017 cycle. So if you have qualms with the quarterbacks, take that up with the guys who are no longer here. And I can already hear the guys who love to harass on Twitter saying, well, isn't that ideal for you to blame the guys who are no longer here? How about I blame the guys who made every decision on quarterback that for the 5 years they were here? Tracy didn't have a damn say in quarterback, as he shouldn't as defensive coordinator. Now it's Tracy making somewhat of that decision, but a large part of it is Jay Johnson. So again, is Mitch the greatest quarterback in the world? No. Is he the greatest quarterback in the Big Ten? No. Is he even in the top three quarterbacks in the Big Ten? I don't think so. But he, what's wrong with him being the fifth best quarterback? What's wrong with that? I don't know. Luke, let's just switch to offensive line. Let's not turn this into a quarterback show.
I think we've largely already hit on the offensive line. They were mediocre at best and not anywhere near as consistent as you'd like them to be. You know, the fact that they were able to rush for 235 yards, you already highlighted, was largely in part due to, you know, the read option with Leidner and Smith, and Smith being able to make, you know, something kind of out of nothing.
Yes. Did the offensive line do some good things? They absolutely did, and I'll be able to show all of you that on my gift breakdowns tomorrow and on Tuesday. But majority of the plays, it wasn't good, folks. Purdue's defensive line, and maybe some of that is because they were timing it up on the clap count. But from going back and watching that back, it wasn't always even on the clap count. It was when Mitch was under center and he was motioning a guy across the formation. Purdue, it was timing those snaps as well. And Clay's had talked about how he wanted to change the snap cadence so defenses couldn't time it. Folks, that first quarter and a half, they were starting to time it. Now, is all of that on the cadence there? Absolutely not. Minnesota played three different guards in the first 15 minutes of the game, and it's not all injury related. I'll just put it at that. The offensive line was underwhelming, and they gave up four sacks. The offense still was able to put up 466 total yards of offense despite of it. But this offensive line, it needs some work, I think, across the board, and they did get better in the second half. I think that Vincent Calhoun specifically started to play better, and just this entire group played better in the second half than they did in the first. But that's the crazy thing, Luke. This offense still put up 23 points, and the offensive line just wasn't able to get pushed, you know, whether it was power or zone. And I'm sure we'll talk about it when Derek's back next week, but it just wasn't working. Minnesota was, they weren't getting in their combo blocks. They weren't getting push. It's just Rodney. When Rodney had a sliver, he did some things, but more times than not, he had to create so much on his own.
Well, let's not forget too, Persick's been out what, 3 weeks?
Yeah, Persick definitely was adjusting.
Right. Well, there, I mean, there's
first
that,
half.
But the fact that, you know, they had to they reshuffled. Green stayed at left. You know, Persick comes back.
Absolutely. And so you have you had so much. You didn't have a lot of continuity,
right?
I think is what. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's
just
exactly what I'm trying to get at. Is there wasn't continuity. This is probably the first time they played with that line combination all year. So, like, in some ways, that's not a huge surprise. It's almost kind of like the first game of the year in some ways, but. Yeah, it's tough to be able to, you know, have the kind of the gel and continuity you want when you really haven't had any time together.
And that may be one of the reasons that Minnesota is in the bottom 25 in adjusted line yards. And that's something I've talked about a lot on Gopher Illustrated. It's a metric from SB Nation Football Study House, Football Study Hall, excuse me, that looks at how much of the running back or how much of your rushing yards are due to your offensive line play. And how much are due to your running backs. And some of the metrics you use are, you know, Rodney looking at that from in terms of, you know, how many yards is he getting before contact? How many yards is he getting after contact? How many yards is it before he's seen contact of any kind? And Minnesota's in the bottom 25% or the bottom 25 teams.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe some of that is the continuity on this offensive line, because as we've talked about, you know, Minnesota starting another different line combination because of injury and because of some of it, because of play. They played three different right guards in the first 16 minutes of the game.
Yeah.
And again, yes, Garrison went down with a shoulder injury and hopefully he's going to be back here soon. But even still, folks, it was a work in progress.
Well, let's not forget, you know, Derek has harped on this before that, you know, for offensive linemen, the chance to build confidence between the two guys next to you, or, you know, in some cases it's only one, but, you know, the two guys next to you is so big, and they just haven't had that opportunity due to injury and in a multitude of things. So probably not a huge surprise that they didn't play as well as they could have.
And again, they did start to play better in the second half,
yeah,
which gives me a little sliver of confidence that they can hold that over, and hopefully they're able to keep the same line combination going into that. So you have Donnell, Jared, Tyler Moore, Vincent Calhoun, and Jonah Persia going into Nebraska. But this is an offensive line that's going to have to play much better if Rodney Smith and Shannon Brooks are going to be able to get going, and if this passing game is going to get going. But I do want to talk a little bit about the defense. You know, again, they did struggle in the first half, but I thought that they were able to find some things in the second half. And Minnesota did have, you know, depending on what site you're looking at, they had somewhere between 3 and 5 turnovers on the day. And again, you want to know the reason why Minnesota's winning these games outside of their being able to put out a lot of points. It's because they're forcing these turnovers. And I believe Minnesota was +3 on the day, and that makes them the number one team in Big Ten play. I believe they're +10 in Big Ten play now, and I think +13 on the season in the Tate Give. So you had Steven Richardson come alive on back-to-back plays. He has a sack, and then he gets a strip sack. Duke McGee on the first possession of the second half is able to take advantage of an interception there. Minnesota holds them on 4th and 1 to start the game. So this is a very opportunistic team. This defense is giving the offense chances at points, and Minnesota's being able to turn those opportunities into points, which is a huge reason for the amount of success they're having.
Yeah, I think it's pretty obvious if you just look at the box score. You know, Purdue had 28 points. Let's put that with an asterisk that 7 of those really shouldn't count against the defense. But then second half, so 20. Mm-hmm. Let's call it 21 to be fair, right?
24. They scored 31. You take out the touchdown, but at the end of the half.
I'm saying in the first half. So first half, 21, right?
Yep.
And then you look at that second half. They only gave up 3 points in the second half. I don't know what they had yardage-wise in
the second
half.
Purdue was awful in the second half. Yeah. They scored 7 total points, but even still, for a team that put up 28 and they were just picking you apart through the air,
yeah,
the defense did do some – they did play much more consistent and much better.
Yeah, so my point is kudos to you, Jay Sauvel. Kudos to you, rest of the defense. You know, you made the right adjustments, and now I understand that, you know, this isn't a club that excels in the second half of games, but, you know, they made the adjustments and then ultimately, you know, improved drastically and put the team in a position to win.
Absolutely. I mean, the amount of – I know we've done a lot of complaining on this, and I hate to be this negative because this is a 7-win team.
It's really fun to complain.
It's constructive criticism. Yeah, you know, it's not all just complaining.
It's fun to complain when you're winning games, though, right? You're trying to go up another level by nitpicking, right? And that's what we're able to do. So
to correct my earlier point, Minnesota was only +2 in the take give. But even still, that's another plus game for this defense. They had 12 tackles for loss, 6 sacks, 2 forced fumbles, 3 passes broken up, and that Duke McGee interception.
That Duke McGee interception was absurd. I still, I was so surprised they overturned it because you can't see, like, there's no way, right? Hypothetically, that the guy has control of the ball, but like you don't actually see that he doesn't. And how he was able to come away with it, it boggles my mind.
Yeah, another guy in defense I really want to talk about is Blake Cashman because he's very, very interesting to me, especially now that Cody Polk is more than likely out. He injured his shoulder diving and getting a tackle on the play, and he never returned. And then we'll come back to the Nick Rallis targeting debacle of Big Ten refereeing 2016, but Blake Cashman is someone that I think is, if you're looking for someone who's going to step into that role next week, I think Blake is a fantastic option. And one thing I've noticed from Blake, and we've talked about him as being the Heath Farwell of Minnesota's special teams, Farwell being a Pro Bowl special teams player for the Vikings in the early 2000s. And Blake plays with such energy. And when you see him being thrown into these sub packages on defense where he's getting 10 to 15 reps on these passing situations and they're blitzing him, he's fantastic in using his hands as a weapon. And what I mean by that is a defender or an offender will be coming at him, and he's able to use his hands to swipe down or use his hands to to throw him aside and get to the quarterback. And he plays with such energy that he never gives up on the play. And he comes through with such speed and velocity that he's able to convert on these things. He had 3 tackles for loss and 2 sacks. I think that he is someone that Jay Sauvel needs to utilize more because I think he's Minnesota's best blitzer in terms of their linebacker. you know, other guys that you could throw in that conversation are probably Kamal and Carter, but they're being used more as rush ends, not necessarily a blitzing linebacker right now. But it is very, I mean, it's fun to say Minnesota finally has one of these walk-on linebackers that Wisconsin has made so famous over their last few years. I think Minnesota has one in Blake Cashman, and I think that he's someone that needs to be seeing more opportunities, especially in passing situations, because he is one of the Minnesota's best blitzers. What do you think?
Well, I don't know much about Blake Cashman. I knew he was a walk-on. Where's he from? Is he from Eden Prairie?
He's an Eden Prairie walk-on. He played as a true freshman last year as a walk-on on special teams. Someone that they had as a defensive back. He outgrew the position. They moved him to linebacker, and he's been absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, he's got
Mike Sherrills and company. So now that Rallis is out, and I'm not very optimistic that Cody Polk's going to be able to play, I think Blake and Jalen Waters are two guys that you're going to see get more opportunities in the first half, and I think that Blake especially has absolutely earned them.
Do you think Blake is an inside linebacker? Because that's kind of where he'd been playing. What did he come in as? I don't remember.
He came in as a defensive back, and that's where he outgrew the position.
Got it.
I don't know that we necessarily really need to put a position outside of linebacker on Blake in terms of inside or out.
Yeah, okay.
Because what he is a very good pass rusher. Sure. I'll say that. And he excels well in space. So I think that he's just someone that you need to be giving more of a look to, you know, especially now that you don't have to take that away from someone like Cody Polk or Nick Rallis because they one out with suspension, one out with an injury. So he is someone that I'm very, very interested to see. So you may have Blake Cashman and Carter Coughlin here for the next 2 years after this, forming a pretty formidable duo in the linebacking core. So that's something I'm pretty interested in. And then another thing about this defense that I want to talk about, outside of Demarius's gaffe there on the post where he got turned around, I thought he was fantastic.
Yeah, in space
eight
in particular.
He was eight solo tackles. He was really direct. I mean, he is the leader in the signal caller, quote-unquote, there of this Gopher defense in terms of getting everybody lined up. If you go back and watch the tape, he's always trying to communicate with this back seven, trying to put them in positions where they're supposed to be, especially with the amount of youth that they have on this defense. I think that, again, Minnesota would be lost on defense without him. They already are playing a true freshman safety in Antoine Winfield. So,
yeah.
Demarius, again, I hate to really to bad talk him, but again, he did get turned around on that post. And it's really one of the first few negatives you've seen from him this year, but I think he made up for it in the remainder of the game.
Yeah. Yeah. He had a real nice game, open field tackling. He's about as sure the surest open field tackler they have. I thought Winfield again had another nice game. I thought, you know, he seems to just be opportunistic, right? Is this the second game in a row that he has a fumble recovery? I think so. Yeah. I mean, he just seems to be in the right place at the right time, and he wraps up pretty well when he can get some hands on some guys. So I don't know. I like the trajectory of the defense from a player personnel standpoint, you know, because they're playing so many young guys. My concern going forward is just that defensive line, you know, in future
generating
years.
Pressure.
Yeah, generating pressure in future years and even with the remainder of this season, because they have to blitz, and it's a bummer when you have the kind of secondary that, you know, you've had over the years that you can't somehow find a way to put pressure on and give those guys a little bit more of a chance to shine.
Yeah. And again, the double-edged sword there is what I'm trying to explain is if you're not generating enough pressure, the quarterback has all day to have his receiver get open because you have 4 or 5 seconds in the pocket. But the double-edged sword there is if you go cover zero and you blitz, if only one guy gets beat by a half a step and he misses a tackle, they're gone.
Yeah.
So that's the fine edge line that you have to walk there. But enough about the defense, Luke. We got to talk about arguably the player of the game in Emma Carpenter.
Yeah.
52, 53, and 28-yard field goals, all good, 3 of 3 on the day. And I believe he only had 2 kickoffs returned.
Can you believe, actually, that at one point when we started previewing the season, this was like one of our biggest concerns?
Well, I think it was worth merit because what we had seen from Emmett in fall camp wasn't exactly
right. But I mean,
great. But the way he's been able to turn it around this season, I, to your point, I think is one of the big another one of the big success stories from this store, from this season thus far.
I mean, I'm not trying to compare, right? Well, I am trying to compare. I mean, at this point, would you rather have Emmett Carpenter, or would you rather have Blair Walsh kicking a 35-yard field goal at any point in the game, right? Like,
oh, that's mean. Here's the thing about Emmett this season. He's 16 of 18. He's converting 89% of his field goals. And here's the crazy part about it. He's 7 of 7 from 40-plus.
Yeah, that's absurd.
He's 7 of 7 from 40-plus. And again, he makes both of his 50-yard attempts. And he's able just to put, you know, this offense that is seeming to be struggling between the 30 and the 50 in opponent territories, he's able to alleviate some things there because he's been so accurate. Again, I think he was added to the Lou Groza Award watch list this week. He was one of the semifinalists, and I absolutely believe that is worth merit. And he has been fantastic, and he was once again. I stand corrected. Purdue only had one kickoff on the day, so he was able to corner kick them, and Minnesota's strategy was to make sure that Brian Langford Johnson, someone from Creighton-Durham Hall who went to Purdue, didn't have any opportunities to take it out of the end zone. He's extremely fast. So he was able to corner directionally kick it, and he was able to be 3-on-3 on field goals. Plus, Santoso was consistent, Luke.
Yeah. Well, here's another thing that we talked about before the season. You know, maybe Santoso would take the long kicks, right? And Emmett would handle like everything like 45 and in.
That had been the talked about plan.
Yeah, and that hasn't had to happen. Yeah.
No, Emmett's been fantastic.
Yeah, he's been fantastic.
Here's the shocker that the walk-on from Green Bay happens to be a success story part two. Obviously, Peter Martel going from a walk-on from Green Bay. Now, Emmett Carpenter, I'm hoping that there's another specialist from Green Bay that's hoping to walk on here at Minnesota very soon.
Yeah, the pipeline's alive. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about Santoso. He was good. Thankfully, you know, he didn't have a shank, right? But it seemed like maybe they simplified it. I wonder if there's a special teams coordinator that listens to a podcast where we talked about, you know, let's simplify some things and just take advantage of some of the natural skill sets that Santoso has by able to just, you know, hang the ball up there. I thought he was good. You know, coverage was good again. I don't have the stats in front of me in terms of how many were fair catches, but that's something that I know that they typically track. It felt like a lot of those were fair catches too, which is typically a pretty good thing as well.
Yeah. I think you and I were talking in the pre-production meeting about maybe they were just not trying to have him directionally kick it as much.
Right.
And just say, kick it 40 plus yards, but just give it some oomph behind it.
Yeah.
Look at that analysis that you're not going to find on any other Gopher podcast.
Is the technical term oomph?
Let's give it some hang time. How about we get technical there? Yeah. So you can allow your coverage team to get downfield. And so you make sure it's a fair catch every time. And again, I believe he had a net average of 41 yards per punt. He had an average of 42 other yards. Raw yards? No. Regardless of the point, two inside the 20 and a net average of 41 is going to do some things, especially because they only had one punt return in the day and that only went for 5 yards. So Santoso was consistent. Again, you'd like to see maybe a 50-yarder considering the leg he has there, but from the struggles he had in previous games, I think that Saturday was a step in the right direction as well.
Yeah. All right, let's get to the A topic of the game.
the Rallis play of 2016.
Yeah. So what is targeting again? Because I'm not really sure anymore.
Yeah, I just...
I don't know. I don't know. There's much to talk about. So you watch the play. I don't remember exactly what Glenn Mason had to say, but after, you know, he makes the hit, Mason says something to the extent like, that's a textbook tackle. It might not have been those exact words, but that's kind of what I felt like he was insinuating. And then all of a sudden, whistle blow must have blown, right? And they throw a flag. So either the monitor booth or official saw the replay. I don't know how that actually happens, how that technically works, but then they throw the flag and now we're reviewing it for a targeting. And again, it comes down to the flaw in the rule. There's a lot of flaws in the rule. One being the ejection, The other being, you know, the letter of the law, that, you know, face mask to face mask. This, I don't even know what this was. I don't know how they justified that this was targeting.
The only thing I can think of is the fact that I believe he left his feet to make the play, and he led with theoretically the crown of his helmet to an extent. And it's any play like that to the upper extremities, regardless of the point, that is a football. He doesn't hit helmet to helmet, and he leads with his shoulder. And it's just, it's absolutely infuriating. And for those who haven't seen Mike Pereira, who is one of the radio, or excuse me, TV guys that was a former ref, he goes on BTN afterwards, and he's like, that shouldn't have been targeting to
actually,
any degree.
Actually, I'll clarify that. That was during the game. So they phone into him, and he says, you know, I'd really like to see him reverse this. This seemed like a good play. And then they don't, and he was surprised. So that was actually during the game he said that.
Yeah, so the worst part about it is now Rallis is out for next week, and or the first half of next week, excuse me. I had that wrong on Saturday night, and I was corrected. But what, and just the mind-boggling part about it is the call on the field was confirmed. And yeah. And Ryan James, Gopher Illustrated Zone, had a great point to where he made this point today on Twitter, was the only time he's seen targeting reversed was on that Ohio State play when Minnesota played them last year on the pick six, and where it was helmet to helmet contact, and he led with his helmet, and he makes the point that it's because it's Ohio State and Minnesota's Minnesota. I don't know that I necessarily agree 100% with that, but why was it targeting? Again, maybe by the letter of the law, because he left his feet and delivered a hit to the upper extremity of a potentially defenseless player. But he led with his shoulder, and he didn't get helmet-to-helmet contact. Nick Rallis is all of 5'10". Really? Where else do you want Nick to lead with his shoulder? He's already 5'10", and so he hits a body part that's about 5'3" off the ground. He hits him in the shoulder. He hits him below the shoulder.
Right.
And now he's out for next week, or the first half of next week, excuse me, once again. But
yeah, I think that like we said last week, where Greeter said that the extent that, you know, the assumption with targeting is that it's dirty. Well, the game is really predicated on speed. There was nothing dirty.
It's predicated on bang bang plays.
Right. And the fact that it was targeting was not a dirty play by Rallis, and that's why they should review the plays to determine the suspensions. I think it's unfair to Rallis, because I think what the coaches should say is, so how do you want us to teach it? So you see this, tell us how we teach this better. Like,
yeah, and Clay's was funny with it after the game, and he goes, I would comment about that, but I would like to not lose any money to the Big Ten this week. So,
right.
And then somebody pressed him about it again, and I'm sure you can watch it on YouTube. And he's like, you guys are making me awfully close to saying some things that are going to be getting me in a very, very big amount of trouble.
Right. I just don't know. It boils down to, so you fundamentally are going to just change the game. It has to be cleaned up, right? There shouldn't be the helmet-to-helmet hits. But the consistency is very difficult.
Mind-boggling. It is absolutely, yeah. That call against Rallis, it is called targeting. For like the Texas hit against Torrey Hunter-Smith in the end zone isn't targeting. Or there was a Stanford play earlier this year where the man was knocked unconscious. Yeah. And they went back and looked and said it wasn't targeting when it was helmet to helmet and he launched.
Well,
let's go
back to Ryan James's comment, right? The Ohio State game 2 years ago, right? Or was
last year.
Last year, yeah. And that one got overturned, right? If I'm correct, yes, it did.
It was overturned. I didn't know things could be overturned, but they are when you're Ohio State. So.
Yeah.
I've never seen another targeting call overturned in college football. Again, I don't see a lot of college football games because I do watch only Minnesota and just other Big Ten games for the most part.
Yeah.
But it is rare for that to happen. It is rare.
Yeah, and I think the fact that it was so delayed was the other thing that was very frustrating, probably as a fan.
Yeah, absolutely.
That absolutely made it all the more frustrating because it seemed like a good, clean play. I mean, before the targeting was instituted, no one would have thought anything of that play in previous years because it wasn't an egregious hit. The guy popped up. He didn't make any comment. You know, it wasn't egregious in any stretch of the imagination, but now we're so hypersensitive that, you know, we have to review and scrutinize every little detail, and all of a sudden this is now a suspendable offense.
It is, and Rallis will be gone for the start of next week. So I think Minnesota has the most targeting calls against them this year. There's at least two in my mind that I would 100% argue they aren't targeting. I think the remainder of the four in terms of the letter of the law, it's targeting, but it's like the Jack Lynn play from last week or 2 weeks ago. What do you want Jack to do there? He turns and leads with the shoulder and he happens to be helmet to helmet contact. It's a bang bang play because it's football. And then Rallis he leads with the shoulder, doesn't get helmet to helmet contact. For those clamoring, well, this defensive staff has to teach them differently. What do you want them to teach
them?
Well,
here's the ironic thing, Ryan, is how many targetings do you remember since the rule was instituted since they've been here? I can hardly think of any, right?
And I can point to two plays last week that weren't called for Minnesota's benefit. First play of the game, Leidner slides. Yeah. Defensive back guy comes over the top, hits him with his helmet. Leidner sliding, which is basically what Jonathan Celestine's was. It wasn't called. And then Drew Olatarski on the sideline. Here comes safety guy over the top, leads with his helmet, gets helmet-to-helmet contact, and that's not called. That's what I'm saying. I just want consistency to know what the hell targeting is.
Well, go back to the alleged concussion play for Mitch Leidner against Iowa.
Exactly,
right?
That's helmet to helmet contact as well.
Right. I mean, it's frustrating, and I know that when you change rules and that are really fundamentally changing the game, and they're very subjective, right?
They need to change the wording, and they need to change the consistency.
Yeah.
And the frustrating part about it is the consistency is human error. And it just hasn't been going in Minnesota's favor.
Yeah, I think that they have to go to something where it's some sort of
if you go low, you're going to be ending guys' careers with ACL injuries.
Right. Well, I guess my point would be that they have to come up with a solution on this whole suspension / I'm fine with the 15 yards, right?
That's why can't they go back after the game?
That's what I'm trying to say.
Big Ten and say, yeah, that wasn't targeting. You're not suspended.
Yeah, or if it was, and in the case of Rallis here, there was nothing malicious about it, right? There was obviously no intent. It was just bang, bang, or somewhat accidental. It's not, you're not trying to hurt anybody. You're not trying to go for the head. You know, it's frustrating.
It's, yeah. Yeah. I'm trying to think if there's anything else I want to touch on before we take, you know, a 100-foot view of where Minnesota's at right now. I think we've touched on quarterback well enough. Rodney Smith should be in the conversation of top four running backs, if not top three running backs in the Big Ten. Wide receiver play is
just receiving. I'd say receiving in general is.
We didn't talk a lot about tight end play. There just wasn't a lot to talk about. They didn't really do anything in the passing game. They actually didn't do a dang thing in the passing game.
Right.
So I think Colton Beebe continues to block well, and maybe next year they'll be able to put him in the game plan in the passing game a little bit more. The offensive line, again, I don't particularly think they played very effectively or very well. I think they were underwhelming, but they did start to play better in the second half, which hopefully builds momentum going into.
They didn't play well, but they scored 44 points. So,
and that's again, how crazy is that? It's just, the offensive line doesn't play well. Minnesota has put up four straight performances over 30 points. Offensive line has played much better in the previous three games. On defense, they struck out on cover zero, and that resulted in two plays that were touchdowns. Then they finally switched to cover one, and they only allow 3 points in the second half. So, It's interesting. And then special teams, obviously, with Emmett Carpenter and Ryan Santoso play well. So, Luke, is there anything else you want to touch on before we have our final thoughts here on the Breakdown Edition on Gopher Gridiron Radio?
No, I'd just say that at this point, I'm fairly pleased with where they're at. I know some people are still frustrated, but, you know, they've been able to see some opportunity, and there's more opportunity in front of them, and let's see if they can continue to capitalize on those opportunities, and it'll just be interesting to see where they end up. I for one, I enjoy when they win football games. I don't know about you guys, but...
Oh, my gosh. I'm not going to get into it, but yes.
I just enjoy when they win. Could they be better? Yeah. Have they been historically bad? Yeah, sort of, but they're playing better football. Enjoy it.
They've won they won this week by 13 points. They won last week by 23. They snuck out one against Rutgers, but then they won against Maryland by 21. They've won three of their last four Big Ten games by double digits. And yes, it's frustrating because we still don't really know if this team is really any good. Because the opponents where they did play relatively tougher opponents in a Penn State team that is now probably going to be ranked in the top 10 teams in the country, and then Iowa.
Yeah, go figure on the Penn State thing, right?
Yeah, that's where I had somebody ask me this week, are you surprised that Penn State's number 12? I'm like, hell yeah, I'm surprised. That Penn State team I saw is nowhere near a top 10 team in the country. But maybe it's just, again, we really don't know how good this 7-2 team is right now.
Right.
And we'll find out here in the next 3 weeks. You face Nebraska on the road. Here's one thing I'm going to say. If Minnesota wins this game and Tommy Armstrong doesn't play, please do not tell me how it's just because Tommy Armstrong didn't play. Again, is that going to play a factor in it? If it does happen, yes. But how many times has Minnesota won in Lincoln with a Nebraska team that's still pretty dang good outside of Tommy Armstrong? Going into Lincoln in a night game in the latter half of the Big Ten season, and if you're able to emerge from a victory with a victory there, that is 100%. I think that this team is pretty good. You know, if they're able to beat Nebraska in Nebraska, that means that this team is going to be playing much closer to a complete game, which is something we haven't seen from them. And then you come home and face a Northwestern team that gave Wisconsin a pretty good run for their money and has been playing a much better brand of football lately. I still think that is a game Minnesota wins probably 65% of the time. Again, think what you may about Pat Fitzgerald's team. We'll see where they're at in 2 weeks, because I think that this Minnesota team gets them at home, which they obviously do. And I think that that's a game they should win 65% of the time. And then obviously the Badger game. Man, was I wrong on Wisconsin. And I will 100% eat my words there, because for the amount of injuries they've gone through and the schedule that they had, and I believe they were able to emerge from it 4-2, and their two losses being to an overtime one against Ohio State. And they played Michigan fairly tough as well. And they've lost linebackers. They have a quarterback rotation going right now. It's, you know, again, it pains me to say this.
Give them credit.
But again, but if Minnesota can get to the level of where Wisconsin is, where they're going to be good every season, no matter what seemingly happens, I think you should be very happy as a Gopher fan. But again, how good is this Minnesota team? I'm still not entirely sure, and that's okay. So we're going to find out here in the next 3 weeks. Again, you're on the road at Nebraska. We'll see what happens with Tommy Armstrong this week. You get Northwestern at home on Senior Day, and then you end the season on the road at Camp Randall. So I think there's – what do you think, Luke? What are the odds Minnesota can win two out of the next three games?
Probably less than 50%. I would venture to guess less than 50%, but I wouldn't say, I don't know, maybe 40, maybe 35-40%.
Yeah, I would say somewhere around 35-40 right now. Again,
yeah,
we'll have to see what Nebraska does this week, but Minnesota does have a 4-game Big Ten winning streak right now. And Derek talked about it 3 weeks ago. He said, if Minnesota is able to go into Nebraska with a 4-game winning streak, there's a lot to be said about momentum in college football. And Nebraska is coming off two losses. including the last week where they absolutely got destroyed by 59 points on the road, and they lost their senior leader. And where are they going to be at mentally, and where are they at physically, in case in point to Tommy Armstrong? So if Minnesota is able to sneak out a victory there, and then if they're able to beat Northwestern, it's a very interesting game against Wisconsin. Again, Wisconsin is going to be, you know, they're going to bring their A game. And Minnesota could potentially have that six-game Big Ten winning streak going against a Wisconsin team that's finally hitting the lighter part of their schedule. Again, I'm not projecting Minnesota to beat Wisconsin right now. They absolutely have to focus on the task ahead of them this week, which is Nebraska. So we'll have to see where they're at in 2 weeks when we're recording this from now. But this Nebraska game is going to tell us a lot about what this Gopher football team is in 2016.
Really interested to see what that point spread projection will be for this.
I don't know if we're going to get a Vegas line all week, just because we're not. I guarantee Nebraska tells us nothing. The media nothing about what Tommy Armstrong's status, as they shouldn't. It's a very important game in the Big Ten, and it's the same thing with Mitch Leidner. You're not going to really find out a whole lot when he was out for that Maryland game.
Right.
You're not going to find out a lot about what's going on. It's probably going to come out within 48 hours of kickoff, what the status is there, but we'll have to see.
Yeah. All right. Well, like we said, you know, the Gophers have taken advantage of some opportunities, and they have opportunities ahead of them. And
it's still a 7-2 team that has won four straight Big Ten games.
Doesn't happen a lot.
They've put up 30-plus points in those games, and it's crazy to think Minnesota is 7-2. They've won four straight Big Ten games, and I still really don't know how good this Minnesota football team is.
Yeah, well, regardless, the next 3 weeks will be fun and probably very, very interesting, and we'll probably learn a lot for sure. So
absolutely. So I'll take things out tonight, Luke. So again, for our Gopher Illustrated members, or if you've been a long-time listener, we've had a great discussions on the GI board this week about how did you come to Gopher Illustrated. And it turns out, you know, a lot, or at least a few of the people that spoke up are long-time listeners of this podcast, and they finally pulled the trigger. And trust me, from their testimonials, they've been extremely satisfied with the product, which is great to hear in someone in my position. So tomorrow morning, I'll be releasing my gift rewind of the first half Tuesday. The gift rewind of the second half. Then Minnesota did have four official visitors on campus. Three of the four leave tomorrow morning, so I'll have stories with them probably Monday night or Tuesday. And then we get into Nebraska week. We'll talk with Josh Harvey of the Big Red Report. Where is this team at mentally in the Cornhuskers? And we'll get farther into it as well. And for those who haven't heard, GI is now partnered with Sports Illustrated. So if you're a longtime listener of the podcast, or if you're just a monthly or 6 month subscriber, if you upgrade to a full or purchase an annual subscription, which is $100 value, you get Sports Illustrated free delivered to your house, apartment, wherever you live. You get a year's worth of Sports Illustrated free delivered to your home. So that's just another great added benefit of this Gopher Illustrated membership. So again, we thank you guys for listening. If you want to help us out, and that doesn't require anything further, if you can just rate and review us on iTunes, it really does help other Gopher fans find this podcast. Or if you sit next to somebody at the games that you think would enjoy this, you know, spread it word of mouth. Again, I think Luke and I try to provide the best Gopher content we can for you guys. It's, you know, there's not a lot of sports or not a lot of Gopher radio around in this Twin Cities market, or just the college football market in general. So spread the word to somebody this week, and we thank you guys for listening once again, and go Gophers.